for coming to the first of a planned three-part series, The Challenge, all on Zoom, unfortunately. I look forward to the day when we can actually do this in person at Zeifman's. I see Steve Roth on here. And Steve, thank you very much for making this series possible. I will say that when I emailed Steve about this series a few months ago, I asked him whether we could do this in person at Zeifman's. And he said, not there yet. Lo and behold, I tested positive for COVID 2 days ago. So if we had been doing it in person, I would not have been doing it in person there. So it goes. I'm hoping for the fall that we could have it in person, enjoying lunch together. That would be wonderful. I also want to thank the Bayit and Shari Shamayim for co-presenting this series with us. Next week, I believe we have Rabbi Yehuda Mann, and then afterwards Rabbi Jared and Standig for the third week. Both of them are really stellar, and looking forward to seeing what they produce for the second and third weeks of the series. Please make sure that you sign in via the chat in order to get credit. If you want a credit letter, you do need to do that. I am not recording video. So that's the evidence that you are actually here. You just need your name, unless you're not on the email list for this class. If you didn't get the emails in advance, then include your email address for me as well, please. Thank you very much. So this class, the topic is blood and money, conflict of interest for family members. And it's something that I've discussed with lawyers as well as with CAs in the past, a couple of different times, but I keep updating it and adding it to it and revisiting it. So I think I did one in 2015, 2016 for accountants. It's fascinating to me to see the way the rules change. First of all, there's a big difference between the way the Law Society deals with this and the way that CPA Ontario deals with it. The Law Society's approach is very simple, very straightforward. You know a conflict of interest when you see it, examine it, figure it out. Whereas, as we're going to see, the CPA Code of Professional Conduct is very, very detailed and very complicated. So that's number one that I find very interesting. Number two is that the CPA rules were issued in 2016. There's a big difference between the 2009, the 2009 rules, and the 2016 rules. We're going to be working today with the 2016 rules, and in particular, Rule 204, which defines independence and threats to independence, and Rule 210, which defines processes for dealing with conflict. Everyone clear on what we're doing, what we're talking about? No one ended up here by accident thinking they're at some other class? Okay, I'm going to post the link for the source sheet once again in the chat, and because people have joined in the last minute or two, I'm going to reiterate, you have to sign in the chat. Just send me a quick message with your name if you want to get a credit letter. Without it, I can't give you a letter. I need that confirmation that you're here, even if you registered in advance. Okay, so generally speaking, from a commercial perspective, both within the secular system and within Jewish law, we want to enable every professional to serve every client. We want professionals to be able to find work, and we want clients to be able to find services. Sometimes the client's best interest is actually to ignore conflict of interest. Sounds counterintuitive, but take a look on your sheet, please, at source number one, where I brought it from the CPA code. When assessing a conflict of interest, members or firms should consider the following questions. And one of those questions is, what will be the impact on the party's ability to obtain professional services should the member or firm choose to decline the engagement? In smaller communities where there may be less access to professional services, there may be more occasions when it is necessary to manage conflicts of interest. Manage as opposed to eliminate. That's number one. Number two, Well, the member's or firm's decision to avoid the conflict by terminating the provision of the professional service be a commercially satisfactory solution for the party or parties in conflict. In many cases, the solution to avoid the conflict by terminating the provision of the professional services to each of the parties will not be commercially satisfactory. It is not always feasible or appropriate for the client, let alone, obviously, the professional, to simply say, I'm canceling the engagement. It doesn't necessarily work so well. I just want to note, I saw somebody signed in the chat by just writing hello. So I don't know who that is. I'm going to need a name as opposed to just the word hello. If you want to send it to me directly and not put it out on the chat broadly, that's fine. Okay, but that's how that's the importance of making sure that you are able to serve clients, that clients are served, is that you can provide professors. You have to ask, what's the impact of me walking away? On the other hand, there are fundamental concerns in the professional rules as well as in Jewish law regarding the possibility that professional services could be warped by your own interests. It's not enough to just say, I'm going to be careful about it. And I'm going to start with sources from the CPA Code of Professional Conduct and then move into Jewish law. If you take a look at source number 2 on the source sheet from the CPA Code of Professional Conduct, Rule 202.2. A member or firm shall not allow his or her professional or business judgment to be compromised by bias, conflict of interest, or the undue influence of others. You have to avoid being compromised. And not only that, but Rule 210.1 in source number 3, a member or firm shall determine in relation to a particular matter and before agreeing to undertake or continuing to provide any professional service, whether a conflict of interest may exist as contemplated by Rule 210.2. In other words, you have to be proactive before taking on the engagement. And in the event that it only arises during the engagement, then that's when you have to pursue it. What constitutes a threat to independence? Take a look at source number 4, please, from that CPA code, from the guidance on Rule 204. Independence is potentially affected by self-interest, right? Do you have something to gain by giving a particular result? Self-review, advocacy, familiarity, and intimidation threats. I'm going to talk about some of those. The mere existence of such threats does not per se mean that the performance of a prospective engagement is precluded. The fact that there is a conflict doesn't mean it's over. And we talked about that already in source number 1. The undertaking or continuation of an engagement is only precluded where safeguards are not available to eliminate or reduce the threats to an acceptable level, or where 204.4 provides a specific prohibition. The only time you can't mitigate things is where there are no safeguards to prevent conflict of interest from influencing your service, or where there's a specific prohibition against the service. And we'll talk more about that. But what we're getting, hopefully, from these rules that I'm presenting is the very clear picture that we are concerned about conflict of interest, we're concerned about intimidation, we're concerned about family connections, we're concerned that you might have something to gain by having a particular result, but it may be manageable and it may be in the best interests of all involved to manage it as opposed to knocking it out. Clear? By the way, I didn't mention this before, but it's really nice if I can see you. I recognize some people may be eating lunch and they don't want to be seen chewing, but I'm not recording video. So, you know, it's great to be able to see people. If I can let you see my COVID face, then you can, hopefully also be seen. Okay. Thank you. So, sorry. Thank you, George. Jewish law is also concerned about threats to independence which lead to bad customer service. As an example, take a look at source number 5, please. Source number 5 is from the Code of Jewish Law, specifically Rabbi Moshe Isserles' Ashkenazi part of the Code of Jewish Law. He's dealing with the case of an apotropos. An apotropos is a legal guardian appointed to look after assets of somebody who is not capable of managing their assets themselves, often appointed by a rabbinical court. And Rabbi Isserles writes in source number 5, and I brought you the original Hebrew, but I'm going to stick to reading the English out loud. Some say that just as a guardian may invest with others, so he may accept it for his own ventures. Meaning, you have somebody who's appointed as a legal guardian over some estate assets. He is entitled to invest those in the best interests of the client, whoever it is, you know, whose assets he's managing. So if he's taking care of property for minors, let's say, he doesn't simply leave it status quo. He invests that. So some argue that just like the guardian is able to invest it in random ventures from the marketplace, so too, if he has some kind of venture that he's running, he's able to say, why not use it for my venture? I think the venture is good, otherwise I wouldn't be doing it. Some allow that, as long as the rabbinical court oversees it. However, rabbinical court has to oversee that that investment due to concern for gossip. At the least, we are worried about what people are going to say. So you need to have oversight in order to make sure that this is being done properly. We don't trust him because we are concerned about the personal interest involved. How far do we go in terms of trying to avoid conflict of interest in Judaism? So I give you source number 6, but I have to caution you. Source number 6 is talking about judges in a court who are approached with something that might influence them. The standard in legal proceedings is different from the standards in professional service. I'm only bringing this to you to show how the rabbis are concerned about the influence of one's personal interest. So the passage in the Talmud in source number 6 begins by quoting a verse, and you shall not accept a bribe. What does that teach? What does this teach me? If it's to teach that he should not find the guilty innocent or the innocent guilty, if the point of this passage is to say, don't rule corruptly in a case, the text already says you shall not warp the judgment. I have separate verses that say, judge honestly. Why do you need to tell me about the bribe? So the Talmud says, because even if the payment is encouragement to do well, guy hands you a check and says, this is to make sure you do your job well. I don't want you to favor me. I just want you to do your job well. The Torah says, no, you can't accept that. There's a concern that you'll be biased. Again, that's for legal proceedings. It's different from professional services. Obviously, you get paid to render professional services. My point in bringing it is only to show that we are concerned, even if somebody says to you, do the right thing, and they pay you, you might be biased to help them. Now, going back to CPA Ontario, and going back to financial services professionals, Judaism does not envision a regulatory body for accountants. It's not as though you're going to open up the Code of Jewish Law and say, here are the rules for accountants. What you do have is a general recognition of regulatory bodies in every profession in Judaism. Remember that the Talmud exists in the Roman period. And in the Roman period, general practice of commerce was tightly controlled. You had price controls, you had controls for how people carried out their professions. So with that as a framework, take a look at source number 7, in which the Talmud teaches, townspeople may make rules for measures, prices, and wages, and may fine those who violate the norms. So each profession, or the community, is entitled to regulate how you practice your profession. Applying that to our conversation, it's the right of the profession to say, here are the rules governing conflict of interest because we want to avoid dishonesty because, well, we'll see what we're exactly concerned about. That's where we're going. Clear so far? We're good? Okay, then let's go further. I have 4 questions that I'm hoping to address. We might only get through the first 3. I didn't put them on the sheet. Usually I put them on the sheet. For some reason, I forgot to this time. But I'm going to read them aloud. We will get through the first 3. We might not get through the 4th. First one. Jonathan, a partner in a small accounting firm, specializes in auditing automobile sales dealerships. That's what he does. His brother marries Sarah, who manages customer relations for a Honda dealership. May Jonathan serve on the engagement team for her Honda dealership. Does the fact that his sister-in-law manages customer relations for a particular car dealership, does that mean he can't work on that account? What would you say before we get to any sources? No one flips.
She has very little to do with accounting, where his concentration is.
Good.
So I think he could have enough distance between them to avoid any abduction of them.
Right. So George says she's in customer relations. It's not like he's auditing her work. You know, barring some massive disclosure that he makes that, you know, sinks the dealership, she's not losing her job because of anything that he does. So that's definitely an argument you can make regarding the first case. We're going to revisit it in terms of both the rules of CPA Ontario and Jewish law. Let's talk about the second case. Still building off of Jonathan and Sarah. Sarah started out, as we said, in customer relations. Sarah now becomes the controller of the Honda dealership. Don't ask me how it happened, but she took night courses. Sarah is now the controller of the Honda dealership. Jonathan is concerned for a familiarity threat, right? She is family. She's his sister-in-law. He reports it to the dealer principal. The dealer principal, the client, says he's not concerned. I'm okay with it. I'm not worried about it. You can keep on working for us, and I'm sure you're going to do a fine job. May Jonathan continue to serve on the engagement team? Does that consent suffice? What would you say now? Okay, the optics don't look good. That's a fair statement.
And what the boss says is it should have to be more variance because you have to worry about someone else's impression, not his.
So you're just concerned about public opinion here. You're saying that the consent could work, except that it's going to look fishy. Okay. So
the boss has no problem with him being there because he'll know he'll bend backwards to make sure everything's okay.
Mm-hmm.
He wants his assistant to remain in her position. So.
Right. I definitely hear you. Any other opinions?
Practice, I don't think something like that would work. And the idea is that you've both got to be independent and you've got to appear to be independent.
Right.
Independent. So that's a requirement. That's number one. Number two, for example, I know in a case where somebody was an employee of my firm, for example, and they would have left my firm and they would have gone to work for the dealership and in the controllership position, that would cause a problem, a major problem. And in fact, you would have to have a 2-year hiatus between that in order for you to carry on doing. That depends if it's an engagement. If the engagement is an audit or a review, or if it was just a compilation.
Right.
There's a big difference in the two cases.
Right. So you raised a couple of important points there. Number one, is there an expiration date on a conflict of interest? And number two, it may depend on the kind of work being done. But I'm going to go back to the expiration date point regarding our third case. Jonathan's brother and Sarah divorced in 2010. 6 years later, may Jonathan serve on the engagement team for Sarah's Honda dealership? Can you say, well, now we're not related anymore? Now, there may be some bad feelings, but can he now serve on the engagement team for this account? What would you say? Is there a statute of limitations?
And the optics disappeared.
The optics are gone. No one at this point is going to think there's an issue. Okay, so those are our first three issues. If there's time, I'll get to a fourth, but let me focus on the first three. We have to begin by asking why we are worried about conflict of interest. What is the concern that we have? You tell me. Right. So Joel says, the appearance of fair dealing, right? You're harming potentially your own reputation as well as the reputation of the profession. Even if you do, even if all that you do is honest and above board. And then I would also add, you're harming the client if your interest actually affects your work, right? That's bad news for the client. So both of these are considerations. Yes, Miriam.
Others, outsiders, and if you're in with the person that you're reporting for, how effective can you be as an impartial party for the outsider who's using it, whether it's a bank or a lender or a government right. body, to say that the work that you're doing is totally unbiased?
Right. When you're doing an audit, there, yeah. I'm imagining, you know, you're working for a public company, let's say, and you're auditing everything, and you do bad work because of the conflict of interest, and people are investing on that basis. So that's for sure a factor as well. So,
and the concern though is it's not that a first party is necessarily going to act against the client. It's that there is a perception that he might because of the conflict. So,
right.
We're not concerned with conflicts about substantive issues, or it's the issue, by and large, is an optics one, because we understand that it is possible to act objectively even with a conflict, depending on the person or the circumstance.
So I would almost agree with you. I would almost agree. However, from a Jewish perspective, we'll talk about the secular perspective, but from a Jewish perspective, I look at that and say, you may not know that you're being influenced. There, you know, in every field, and certainly within accounting, it's not black and white. There are gray areas, and there are judgment calls. And there are times when people are going to be influenced in that regard. It's true for accountants, it's true for car mechanics, whatever it is. So, yeah, it may be that our primary concern is the appearance, but I don't think we can discount the possibility that the judgment call will be decided improperly because of the connection. There's a passage in the Talmud where they talk about the Hebrew word for bribe. And the Hebrew word is shochad. And the Talmud actually says shochad is shehu chad. And there are a couple of ways to translate those words, but one way to translate them is it makes the person one with the person who bribed them. In other words, when you have an interest in it to help somebody who has benefited you, it's natural to feel close to them, and that can result in a bias, which one doesn't even detect in one's work. So I would still be concerned about harming the client or the community, even as the major concern is the reputation issue.
I believe there's even a prohibition to take a bribe, even if you know you were going to rule that way.
Yes. Right. Yep, that's correct. Although, again, that goes back to what I said earlier about that being for the legal profession. That's not true in professional representation. So it's important to make that distinction because we are stricter when it comes to legal proceedings. We're going to see that again shortly. So in terms of the concern for harming the client, in the secular system, we have a concern about fulfilling the contractual obligation properly. If you take a look at source number 8, the preamble to the CPA Code of Professional Conduct here in Ontario, chartered professional accountants conduct themselves at all times in a manner which will maintain the good reputation of the profession and serve the public interest. In doing so, members and firms are expected to avoid any action that would discredit the profession. That's the reputation issue. Chartered professional accountants do not allow their professional or business judgment to be compromised by bias, conflict of interest, or the undue influence of others. Clients, employers, and the public generally expect that members and firms will bring objectivity and sound professional judgment to their services. It thus becomes essential that a member firm will not subordinate professional judgment to external influences or the will of others. We voice concern for both aspects. We voice the concern about, yes, reputation, and we voice concern about doing a bad job. Both of these are issues. Now, we still have to figure out what the standard is for defining that, but we're going to come back to that. In Jewish law, this is a religious concern. In other words, right now, from the secular perspective, I look at this and say, this is a social concern. Don't harm other human beings. Jewish law adds that this is also a concern about one's relationship with God. It's a practical social concern, but it's also religious. If you take a look at source number 9, this is a midrash which is commenting on the biblical verse not to put a stumbling block in front of the blind. So the rabbis gave an example. Don't tell someone, sell your field and buy a donkey, while trying to get his field from him. Right? Generally speaking, trading real estate for a donkey is not a good idea. You're giving him bad advice because you want to buy the field. That's a problem. It's a fairly clear-cut problem, not one of those gray areas. But my point in bringing it is that biblical verse, don't put a stumbling block in front of the blind, concludes with the words, I am God. Meaning, God is saying, this is a concern for me. It's not just about your relationship with other people. It's also about your relationship with me. So we're not supposed to give advice based on our personal interest. And the concern, again, is not that a conflict makes somebody incompetent, but rather there's a more subtle type of influence affecting objectivity. This emerges in the judicial system, going over to that, in Jewish law in a very interesting way. If you take a look at source number 10 from the Code of Jewish Law, it's talking about witnesses. And it says, all who are disqualified to judge, if you have a relationship with somebody such that you're not allowed to judge them in court, you're also disqualified to testify. You also can't be a witness on their case. Other than a friend or enemy, meaning judges are not allowed to hear a case for someone who is their friend or for someone who is their enemy. But witnesses are allowed to testify regarding matters involving their enemy or their friend. The point about judges is also seen in source number 11. One may not judge a friend, even if he's not a shushvin. Shushvin was a formal friend relationship that I'm not going to go into right now. It doesn't exist in our day. But you're not allowed to judge the case of a friend or your closest friend or one he hates. You can't judge the case of your enemy, even where he's not like a real enemy. He's just somebody you don't get along with. The litigants must be equal in the eyes and hearts of the judges. And again, this is for litigation. It's a stricter standard than professional services. My point is to show you that we distinguish between judges and witnesses. A judge is not allowed to judge a case involving a friend or an enemy. A witness is allowed to testify. What's the difference? So if you take a look at source number 12, Rabbi Yoshua Falk, in a commentary on the Code of Jewish Law, says something which I think psychologists today would probably disagree with. He says, you know why you can be a witness, but you can't be a judge? In testimony, one testifies about what he saw. We do not suspect that he would intentionally alter it for love or hatred. This is not so in judgment, which depends on logic. One's mind changes due to love or hatred, even without evil intent. He says, judging is something that you do in your head. You make an assessment. There you can be influenced. Testimony is just report what you saw. That you're not going to alter intentionally. He's making a psychological argument. As I said, I suspect that today we would not look at this in the same way. We would argue that people are biased in their perception of events that they witness, and you can't trust them to retell it in an honest way if they're close with whoever is involved. But the point that he's making, which I wanted to draw out here, is that his concern is about that which is subtle, that which is not clear. In other words, it's not about intention. It's not you're going to intentionally provide bad service. It's that it's going to happen naturally. It's going to happen automatically. That's the idea. Rabbi Avraham Yeshaya Karelitz, also known as the Chazon Ish, made a point which I brought you in source number 13. He says, when you look at the Torah's rules regarding bribes and conflict of interest, it's very hard to discern a clear pattern. Example, in the event that go back to the days when instead of, you know, getting your kosher chicken in the supermarket, you actually shechted the chicken, right? You slaughtered the chicken, then had to examine it and make sure the chicken was okay. So let's say the rabbi slaughters the chicken for his own family, and he wants to examine it and make sure that it's all right. Is he eligible to judge whether it's okay? I would have assumed the answer is no, because he has something to gain. Nonetheless, the rule is that he is allowed to judge the kashrut of his own chicken. How in the world does that work? So Rabbi Karelitz argues that God is giving you guidance based on what God knows about human nature, and you can't necessarily make an assumption based on what you would assume was true. It's an interesting statement, worthy of its own discussion. I just wanted to highlight it as something fascinating. But this is our concern about harming the client. We're worried that something subtle, something that you don't even detect, is pulling you in a particular direction. That's number one. And then number two, the issue that Joel pointed out, harming the reputation of the profession. So we already saw that back in the preamble. I brought it in source number 14. You see it as well there. That chartered professional accountants conduct themselves at all times in a manner which will maintain the good reputation of the profession and serve the public interest. And if you take a look at source number 15, the guidance on the CPA code, the confidence that professional judgment has been exercised depends on the unbiased and objective state of mind of the reporting accountant, both in fact and appearance. It's not sufficient that in fact I know I did a good job. I have to worry about what other people are going to see. And that's a concern in Judaism as well. I brought you an example of it in source number 16 from the Jerusalem Talmud, in which we are taught, we find in the Torah, we find in the works of the prophets, we find in the writings, that one must satisfy others as one must satisfy God. First, it quotes from Bamidbar, the book of Numbers, in which we are told, you shall be innocent from God and from Israel, meaning that people should believe you innocent. You have to make sure you satisfy their view. The book of Joshua has a line towards the end of the book. It's a long story, but it's a story involving an incorrect accusation. And the defendant in the story declares by God. They use three names of God. Kel Elokim Hashem. God knows. And Israel knows that what we did was right. And then the book of Mishle, the book of Proverbs, from the third part of Tanakh, says, you shall find favor and a reputation for good insight in the eyes of God and man. This is an imperative, to find a reputation for a good insight. So you have to make sure, like we said above regarding the legal guardian, even if you are trusted, we are concerned about gossip. So to summarize, in both systems, there's a recognition of conflict of interest harming professional judgment and even of the appearance of conflict. That's basically what it amounts to. The CPA code is worried about the profession, which is something Judaism doesn't really talk about specifically. Judaism is worried about you personally. It's worried about you religiously. And those are double concerns. There's also a separate concern in Jewish law, which I didn't really highlight, which is the concern that if a person is seen or perceived to engage in bad behavior, that's going to desensitize others from wrongdoing. Meaning, if I could be doing everything on the up and up, but if people suspect that I am in some way self-dealing, that becomes their judgment, their justification for self-dealing as well. You follow? That's another concern that Jewish law expresses. So let's go back to our cases now. This first case, the sister-in-law who is in customer relations for a car dealership, and you are the accountant who is doing the audit of the car dealership. So now we need to define our standards. What constitutes a close enough relationship and a close enough business relationship that this is going to be a problem? The CPA code comes very close to addressing this. Not entirely clear, but I think close enough, as you'll see. So our main concern here is clearly the family relationship. If you take a look at source number 17 from the Code of Professional Conduct, a member or student shall not participate on the engagement team for an assurance client if the member's or student's immediate family member, the bold is mine, if the member or student's immediate family member is an officer or director of the client or a related entity or is in a position to exert significant influence over the subject matter of the engagement, or was in such a position during the period covered by the assurance report or the engagement period. So you can't be on the engagement team if your immediate family member is an officer, director, or in a position to exert significant influence. Now, I look at that and say, customer relations, does that present a problem? No. There's no reason to think that that presents a problem. Continuing on the top of the next slide, a member or student shall not participate on the engagement team for an audit client that is a reporting issuer or listed entity if the member's or student's immediate or close family member has an accounting role or a financial reporting oversight role or had such a position during the period covered, and so on. Also, not relevant if you're talking about customer relations. It would seem that family is not a problem here. There is also concern for a self-interest threat. If you take a look at source number 18, a person has a financial reporting oversight role when the person is in a position to, that's on what we just talked about. That's just in terms of, what I wanted to show you there was that source number 18, also from the CPA code, gives you particular titles of positions that would be a problem. If your sister-in-law was president, CEO, chief operating officer, chief financial officer, controller, director of internal audit, director of financial reporting, treasurer, possibly general counsel, not head of customer relations. That's what I wanted to show you with source number 18. Like I said in the beginning, the law society is so much simpler. They don't bother trying to give you particular titles. They just say, you know it when you see it. The CPA code is being very granular here. If you take a look at source number 19 now, we talk about it not in terms of family relationships, but in terms of self-interest as a threat. A self-interest threat occurs when a firm or a person on the engagement team could benefit from a financial interest in or other self-interest conflict with an assurance client. Examples of circumstances that may create a self-interest threat include but are not limited to direct financial interest or material indirect financial interest, a loan or guarantee to or from an assurance client or any of its directors or officers, dependence by a firm, office, or member on total fees from an assurance client, that would be bad, undue concern about the possibility of losing the engagement, evaluating performance or providing compensation for selling non-audit services to an assurance client. You have another business relationship. Having a close business relationship with an assurance client. Potential employment with an assurance client. That's where there's an issue of personal interest. Do you think that the sister-in-law relationship rises to that standard? What would you say? I don't think so. I don't think so, because all the examples here are financial. They're all about financial interest. There is something called a familiarity threat, but again, not about customer relations. In source number 20, A familiarity threat occurs when, by virtue of a close relationship with an assurance client, its directors, officers, or employees, a firm or a person on the engagement team becomes too sympathetic to the client's interests. Examples of circumstances that may create a familiarity threat include, but are not limited to, a person on the engagement team having an immediate or close family member who is an officer or director of the assurance client. I don't see that as being an issue in this conversation. What about a financial interest? So your sister-in-law does have financial interest in the outcome of the case. It is certainly true. The I just muted everybody, but it didn't quite take, apparently. Let's try that again. If you take a look at source number 21, a member who is a partner of a firm and who holds, or whose immediate family member holds, a direct financial interest or a material indirect financial interest in an audit or review client shall not practice in the same office as the local engagement partner for the client. If you are a partner of a firm and you have, or your immediate family member has, a direct financial interest, there's an issue. Do you think that qualifies here? Do you think this counts as having a family member with a direct interest? Imagine if something happens as a result of your audit.
But you said she's an employee.
She is an employee.
That's it.
Maybe. Take a look at source number 22. The CPA code defines immediate family member. It's a spouse or the equivalent, or a dependent. I don't think a sister-in-law meets the standard. I think that you're still okay. Now, ultimately, I'm going to say that you go with what says in source number 23, which is, evaluate the significance of the relationship. When a person on an engagement team knows that a close family member has a direct financial interest or a material indirect financial interest in the assurance client or related entity, a self-interest threat may exist. In evaluating the significance of any such threat, consideration should be given to the nature of the relationship between the person on the engagement team and the close family member and the materiality of the financial interest. So, beyond the specific rules and the specific relationships named, evaluate the significance of the relationship, see if you have a problem. Now, this was all secular. What about Jewish law? Jewish law does not provide anything approaching this detailed list of threats and relationships we just saw in the CPA rules. Unlike the CPA rules, which take a very proactive approach to preventing problems, Jewish law places the onus on the individual to figure it out. If there's a complaint, then the courts are going to need to figure out what happened and what went wrong, and was this a problem, was the action inappropriate. So you will not find in Jewish law a list of relatives who cannot provide professional services. It's just not there. You have it in court, but that's it. Here I brought you in source number 24 one note, which again is about judicial proceedings and therefore not entirely relevant. The Hebrew, you can see, goes on to the next page, and then you have my English translation. What is a verbal bribe? They're concerned about verbal bribes, not just financial bribes, but verbal bribes. And they give the following cases. The sage Shmuel crossed a river. Somebody extended his hand to help him across. Shmuel asked, "Why are you here?" And the guy replied, "I have litigation." So Shmuel said, "Well, I can't judge your case because you helped me across the river." Then the sage Amemar, somebody lifts a feather off of his head. He says, "Why are you here?" "I have litigation." "Well, I can't judge for you. You just saved me from embarrassment." Mar Okva spits in front of himself, and somebody then covers it up for him, and Mar Okva asks, "Why are you here?" "I have litigation. I can't judge for you." There is a concern for influence that isn't easily defined. Now, the truth of the matter is, number one, this is judicial process, and number two, it's generally understood that these were stringencies. This was not actually a requirement for them to walk away. It was a stringency they took upon themselves. But my point is only to say Jewish law is very undefined and it really expects you to figure it out in terms of what constitutes a conflict. So the upshot is the secular system wants you to assess everything and to document it, by the way. We didn't talk about that, but to document whatever decision you make and your justification. That's a really important point. Jewish law is going to say, hey, dude, be careful. That's basically what it comes down to. You have to figure it out. Which brings me to question number two. Question number two was the matter of consent. Let's say that the sister-in-law is no longer head of customer relations. The sister-in-law is now controller of the car dealership. Can you be responsible for auditing this car dealership? And we said it would seem the answer is no. But what happens if you raise it to the dealer principal of the dealership? You say, you know, my sister-in-law is the controller. And he says, don't worry about it. I consent to having you provide the service. You've been providing the service for years. I trust you. You'll be okay. I'm good with it. Is consent sufficient? So I think somebody already mentioned when I gave the case in the beginning that consent really shouldn't work because we're concerned about the public. No one is giving the public the opportunity to consent. And what about, again, public perception? Why is it that consent should work when everybody else doesn't know anything about the consent? We have to have concern for what they're going to think is going on. And yet, take a look at source number 25 from the CPA code. Where the agreement to provide any professional service would result in a conflict of interest under 210.2, or where a previously unidentified conflict of interest or is discovered in the course of providing any professional service, the member or firm must decline to provide the professional service or withdraw from providing all of the affected professional services unless, and one of the unlesses is, the affected parties have knowledge of the conflict of interest and their agreement for the member or firm to accept or continue the professional services engagement is implied by their conduct in keeping with commonly accepted practice. They can consent. As long as those who are affected consent, you're good. Very interesting. The Law Society, interestingly, doesn't like this idea. They're concerned about professional reputation and will not accept consent. But CPA Ontario is apparently good with it. What about in Jewish law? So when it comes to judicial proceedings, we say that you are able to accept somebody as a witness or judge despite the apparent conflict of interest. So in source number 26, they talk about litigants accepting someone's relative or a disqualified party, someone disqualified for any number of reasons, as a judge or a witness, and if they performed a kinyan, an act of transaction, an act cementing the transaction, they can't even back out from their acceptance of this person. Judicial proceedings, remember, we've said it repeatedly, are more strict than providing services, and yet we're saying that's okay. The reason why it's okay is because our concern was lifnei iver, putting a stumbling block in front of the blind. However, this person isn't blind. They know what's going on, and they consented. On that basis, they can continue to provide services, and that's just fine. However, I think it's not clear what extent of knowledge they need to have, what level of disclosure is required in order to provide consent. The reason I say that is because of a different area of Jewish law. There is something in Jewish law called ona'ah. Ona'ah means using your strength against somebody else. You have a stronger position than they do. One is ona'as devarim, abusing people with your speech. One is ona'as mamon, abusing people financially. Specifically, going back to Talmudic times, I mentioned before, the Talmud is functioning within a Roman environment in which prices in many markets were fundamentally fixed. A certain range was okay, and that's it. It was called in Hebrew the sha'ar. So the law of ona'ah says a merchant is not allowed to sell somebody goods more than a certain percentage over the going rate. A customer is not allowed to buy goods at a certain percentage below the going rate. So if the going rate is $100 for something, I am not allowed to go to someone who's selling it and say, I'll buy it from you for 50. I can't do it. That's actually called ona'ah. However, what if I tell him straight out, I know this is ona'ah. What I'm doing to you is inappropriate. Nonetheless, that's what I'm willing to offer, take it or leave it. Right? I go to somebody at a garage sale, and I see, and if you saw the article last week, I see that there's a Roman bust in the, in the items that they have for sale. I know this thing is worth uncalculable, right? You can't, who knows how much this thing is worth. They're offering to sell it for $39.99. So, am I allowed to do that as an expert knowing this thing is worth way more? The answer is no. But what if I say to them, listen, I know that this is worth more. Nonetheless, here's what I'm willing to pay you. You should know this is ona'ah. I'm under what it's worth. Is that sufficient? I'm leaving aside any issue of dishonesty in the way you present yourself and what you tell them about what it's worth. Take a look at source number 27 from the Code of Jewish Law. If one party says to another, I am making you the following offer, whether it's a selling offer or buying offer, it doesn't matter, on condition that you cannot claim ona'ah, you will not be allowed to claim that this was inappropriate, he, the other party, can still claim ona'ah. That doesn't get me out of it. This is true where he did not specify, because the other person doesn't know how much ona'ah is present in order to forgive it. So I need to specify not just I am underpaying or overcharging, but I am underpaying by this amount. I am overcharging by this amount. That's the demand. I have to be very clear about what is involved. So I wonder, when we talk about consent in Jewish law, and we say that consent is fine, I wonder if the client doesn't need to know an awful lot. It isn't enough to say, my sister-in-law is your controller. Maybe there's a requirement for more disclosure in order to make sure that the consent is informed consent. Not sure. Third and last question. We're not going to get to the fourth one that I had in mind. But the third question. Again, the sister-in-law, Sarah, is the controller for the car dealership. You want to be on the engagement team for the car dealership. You can't, because she's your sister-in-law and she's the controller. However, then the sister-in-law is no longer a sister-in-law, right? The brother and Sarah are divorced. 6 years go by. Is it now okay for the former brother-in-law to serve on the engagement team with this dealership? How much time has to elapse? So the CPA code is actually very clear. We saw it above. We saw it in one of the earlier sources. The answer is they just can't be related right now. That's all that we care about, is that they're not related at this time. It was in, which one was it in? It was 14 and 15. COVID is getting to me. It was in one of the sources that we had earlier that they can't have the relationship right now. But in the event that the relationship, oh, you know where it was? It was in source number 17. It's in source number 17. It has to be the member or student's immediate family member at this time. It's not, during the engagement period, but not if they had that relationship in the past. Now, we could still come back and say, but there's a familiarity here and maybe you should still be careful. Nonetheless, the CPA code seems to think you can be okay. What about Jewish law? So Jewish law distinguishes between two different kinds of relationships, and I see that we're getting close to the end, but I think we can do it. It distinguishes between business relationships and family relationships. Business relationships are only current as far as we are concerned. If you take a look at source number 28, the Talmud says, regarding litigation, partners, business partners, are able to testify for each other. The Talmud asks, why are they able to testify? They have an interest in their testimony. Yeah, they first have to put down in writing, we have no claim in this field that we used to be partners in. You have to eliminate the partnership, and then you can testify. And this comes up in the very interesting case in which there's a city and a Torah is stolen from the city. And the question of whether the citizens of the city are able to testify regarding the theft. And maybe they can renounce their membership in the city or their ownership of the Torah. It's a fascinating discussion in its own right. But the point that I'm bringing this for is to say, in Jewish law, business relationships are only current, but not family relationships. Family relationships continue beyond the actual relationship. And that's what you see in a comment in source number 29. Tosvot, an anthology of commentaries from Western Europe, 12th century through the 14th century or so, makes a comment on that passage in the Talmud. And what it says is this. You're telling me that in the event that the partners renounce their partnership, they can testify. He says, I don't understand. You witnessed the event when you were still partners. He says, don't we require that they be acceptable from beginning to end? Here the witnesses began in disqualification. They saw the event when they were disqualified. To which the answer is, they're like someone who, still the question. They're like someone who was a relative and is no longer related. So he says, no. The concern for having been disqualified at the outset is irrelevant here. The disqualification is a function of money, not to their person. As long as right now there is no financial relationship, that's fine. But did you notice what Tosva threw in the middle? The relative. If indeed the disqualification is personal, because you're a relative, then the concern continues. The concern does not stop. So what we're saying, to summarize everything that we've said, overall, we're concerned about diminished independence affecting professional judgment, both in the CPA code and in Jewish law. Jewish law is also concerned about personal reputation and damage to society. Judaism does not have the dimension of protecting the profession. But what Judaism does have is a concern that the reputation for conflict of interest is going to result in other people being desensitized. That is a concern. We said having an in-law and customer relations is not a problem within the CPA code. You have to evaluate the significance of the relationship, but that seems fairly clear. Jewish law does not give clear guidance. It says you know yourself best. Would we accept, I'm just doing the summary, would we accept consent? The CPA code seems to say yes. Jewish law would require full knowledge, I think, of potential bad advice, which I think is unlikely to happen, getting that level of disclosure. Because you can't give it. I don't know if anybody knows at that stage what the potential extent is. And when a family relationship ends, how much time must elapse? So from the CPA code perspective, we just care that you're not related now. And then if you know there's no significant relationship, you're fine. And in Jewish law, personal relationships continue even after they have ended. I'm feeling like this was a little bit dull. I apologize. It's hard to be energetic at the moment, but I hope it was at least clear, if not exciting. God willing, Rabbi Mann next week and Rabbi Anstandig the week after, and they will be exciting because they are exciting speakers. So as long as they can stay away from this, it'll be good. Again, a reminder, please make sure you sign in order to get a credit letter. That's vital. And now I'll stick around to take questions from people who have questions or comments. Thank you. Okay, then thank you very much, and enjoy next week's class. Yeah, Burl.
In note,
Yeah.
When Mar Ukva said he couldn't be a judge.
Yeah.
Or the others. Then we look back at note one.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there had to have been other judges.
Oh, you mean in terms of harming them because now they have no recourse to get a judge if he's going to disqualify himself. Right, so I think you're right, and I think we have to go back to that principle that we stated, that you have to make sure you're not leaving people high and dry. It reminds me, you know, something that's a concern within the law society for conflicting out, where people, especially in a divorce case, this I think is common, will have meetings with members of a range of firms in order that the firms should now have a conflict of interest so that the other side will not be able to use them for representation. I think, you know, without discussing conflicting out in that practice, I think that there has to be a concern. Mar Okva has to know there are other people who can hear it. Otherwise, he doesn't have the right to be stricter than the law at the expense of people who need to be heard. I would agree with that. Yeah. Okay. And thank you very much, everyone. All right. Be well.